As you probably know, K. Scott Allen died on January the 10th, 2020. In 2015, Scott was kind enough to make a podcast with me, and that's what I'm releasing here. I was fortunate enough to meet him on a few occasions in the following years. He was always friendly, generous, and humble. I'm sad that our paths will not cross again. This is a No Dogma podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this evening I'm joined by Scott Allen, author, Pluralsight author, and founder of Ode to Code. Thank you for joining me, Scott.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell me a little bit about yourself and your background first?
Sure. I've been developing software for over 25 years now. I started when I was 12 years old, which would actually make that number of years even larger, but I don't count the early years when I wasn't getting paid. But I have my own consulting company that's Ode to Code. I do a lot of work in the Mid-Atlantic region, a lot in the healthcare industry, and do some Pluralsight videos, and live in Maryland.
So tonight we're going to talk primarily about ASP.NET 5. And one of the things I was wondering when I was reading about it was, is it a complete rewrite?
You can think of it that way. Essentially, the ASP.NET team sat down and said, if we were to start from scratch, what would it look like? And although you'll find a lot of very familiar concepts, particularly if you've done ASP.NET or ASP.NET Web API programming, you'll find a lot of the same classes and concepts, and many things will be familiar. And I'm sure a lot of the code behind the scenes looks just like the code that was in previous versions of ASP.NET, Web API, and MVC. But for the most part, you can think of them starting from scratch and rewriting this.
Was that something that they felt that they wanted to do earlier? Maybe like they just didn't want to do it at 4.4.5.1?
I think there's been some increasing thoughts that way over the years. And particularly if you look at like the Web API stack that came out a few years ago, that was developed pretty much independently of ASP.NET. So there wasn't any dependencies on an ASP.NET runtime or on IIS being there at runtime. And I think that gave people a lot of ideas about what a web framework could look like today when you might not want to run on a Windows server all of the time, or you might just need something very lightweight to serve up JSON data and not necessarily have a big stack that's full of controls and handlers and modules and session state and all the things that you use to be able to throw into an ASP.NET application. People are just building applications a little bit differently these days. I mean, people who are building single page applications quite often are just sending down HTML files and JSON data. So the whole idea of server-side rendering and all of the baggage, for lack of a better term, that comes with that, some web applications don't need that anymore. But I think I was pushing people towards, you know, looking at how can we make the runtime, the ASP.NET runtime, a little more flexible and more lightweight, and how can it adapt to the way people are writing applications these days.
We'll get into kind of some of the new features as we go through this podcast, but of the new features, what would you say are the things you appreciate the most?
I love the fact that there's really no manifest anymore that says these are the files that are in my web application. So previously, if you're building a web application with Visual Studio, you have to have some sort of project file, a CSproj file or a VBproj file. And inside of that file, there was a list of everything that was in your web app. And for some scenarios, that was okay. But I always felt like it created a lot of friction. It creates frictions on teams when people are merging changes into the CSproj file. It creates friction when all you want to do is just dump a JavaScript library or a CSS library and all of its images into a folder and just have it work, because you always had to tell Visual Studio to add those things to the project file if you wanted them to be managed properly as assets and have them in source control and so forth. So to me, just this idea that you can point a tool or a utility to launch a web application, just point it to a folder and say, yeah, my website's here, and just have it use everything that's inside, I think that's great. And that was one of the first things that jumped out at me, actually.
Do you need to have Visual Studio 2015 to run .NET 5? Sorry, ASP.NET 5.
ASP.NET 5, no. In fact, you can download this runtime independently of the regular .NET runtime and independently of Visual Studio, and you can run things on Linux and OS X and write the code with Notepad or a lightweight text editor like Atom or Sublime or Visual Studio Code. So Visual Studio 2015, although it will have some tooling for ASP.NET 5, so for some people it will make for a nicer experience to do those things through an IDE. There's really no ties to Windows or Visual Studio anymore.
So that's something I'm going to ask you about as well very soon. But so from the perspective of modularity, is this different than just, NuGet came along maybe 4 or 5 years ago and gave us fantastic modularity, but I get the impression ASP.NET 5 is even more modular.
I think it is more modular. They are certainly breaking pieces down into smaller units, smaller components, and packaging things up as smaller units, because one of the ideas was to get away from shipping a monolithic framework so that if you needed to, let's say, add one new security provider or change just one little thing inside of the ASP.NET runtime, that you had to ship the whole runtime again. Now everything is very modular, distributed via NuGet. Some people, I would suspect, say maybe it's a little too modular, because now, instead of just adding one or two NuGet packages and their dependencies and saying, hey, I have everything I need, now you have to think about things like, do I have to serve static files? Well, if so, then I need to pull in the static files module, reference that and have it downloaded and make sure it's configured into my runtime just to serve up static files off the file system.
That does sound different than what we're used to.
It's very modular. And I've heard a couple of discussions about things they might do so that you don't become overwhelmed with the complexity of all the little pieces that are going in there. For example, they might have, I'm not sure what term they're using for it, but like a meta NuGet package. So you pull in this ASP.NET NuGet package, and it'll pull in the 30 or 50 common things that you would typically use. And that would be one way to avoid being overwhelmed. But it really, I mean, there was two motivations, I guess, for making it very modular. One was that they wanted to be able to independently ship and update and iterate different parts of the framework. And two is I think a lot of the rest of the web development community is used to that style of pulling in very small pieces instead of big frameworks. So certainly if you look at the Node community, they're accustomed to pulling in very small components through a package manager that do very specific things.
You touched on the whole cross-platformness of it all. So, you know, there have been moves with likes of Mono and other things to get your C# onto Linux and Mac, but I get the impression, again, that ASP.NET 5 is much more capable in those terms.
Well, Microsoft is building a core CLR, what they call a core common language runtime, that will be cross-platform. So it will run under OS X and under Linux distros and on Windows too. And because, you know, Mono is a great runtime, but now you also have Microsoft's backing and Microsoft open sourcing things. So all of the research and the, you know, I don't know how many tens of thousands of engineer hours have gone into the .NET framework, everyone's going to be able to benefit from that.
But when you say a core, is it going to be a subset, like a subset that's more difficult to work with? Like when I started working with Windows Phone 8, I couldn't do a DNS lookup very easily.
Very similar concept. So it's not taking the full .NET framework and porting over WCF and all these other things. It's a very small subset of the .NET framework. And of course, it will include things like all the useful things that are in MS Core Lib, and all the basic types will be there. But if you want to do a DNS lookup, I'm not sure if that's there, but I have to check. I know things like the SMTP client aren't there. There are some types that are present, but they don't have all of the same features. So, for example, there's some reflection APIs that just aren't available on the core CLR right now. Maybe they'll be there in the future, but it's very similar. If anyone has developed for Windows Phone or for Silverlight or for Windows Embedded, you've probably faced that situation where you've gone to use something on those runtimes and you either get a not supported exception or something doesn't build because an API just isn't there at all.
But
that will be the core CLR.
So with the likes of, you know, as you say, SMTP sender is not there. If I was to go into the Microsoft's, the bigger, let's say the framework I'll deploy on Windows, I can take that source code. If I take that, can I just include it in my application that I'm going to deploy to Linux and Mac and expect it to work? Or would there just be too many dependencies that it would need that would be missing, and I'd have to get the source code of them also, and so on and so on?
Oh, so you're saying like take the source code of an existing? Yeah, that could work. It would depend on how many dependencies are there. Yeah,
so it is.
But I imagine there's some areas like that where Microsoft might say, you know, people who are going to need SMTP communication from their web application, maybe no one's doing that anymore through C# code. Maybe they're all doing it through services or something like SendGrid, or doing an HTTP post somewhere, and that some third party takes something and sends off an email.
Well, what about something more likely wanting to host a website or a web service? Are you going to have to rely on OWN at that point for Linux deployments?
Microsoft's writing a server called Kestrel, which will be a cross-platform tool. I'm not sure of the entire story there. I'm not sure, like, if you're on a Linux distro, will you be able to run ASP.NET 5 under Apache? I would suspect there'll be something that comes along that allows you to do that if it's not there already.
That would be impressive.
But for right now, if you want a simple development web server on OS X or Linux, then you would use this tool called Kestrel.
Hmm. Is ASP.NET 5 going to be lighter on resources?
It's definitely lighter. I know one of the goals that the team had was to get rid of system.web and all of the baggage that system.web carried with us. And one of the things that system.web.dll would do is set up a context on every HTTP request. And the numbers I've heard are that context, typically about the smallest you could get it, would be around 40 kilobytes. So every HTTP request that comes in with the old ASP.NET runtime, you'd have a minimum of 40 kilobytes pop up to manage that request. In ASP.NET 5, they're trying to make things as lightweight and as efficient as possible. And I've heard that context now, you measure it in the 3 or 4 kilobyte range. Nice. To start with, you know, depending on what features you want to add in. But if you're building something that's lightweight and it's not doing a whole bunch of fancy things and needs all sorts of, I don't know, if you're building something that's fairly targeted and is just maybe serving up JSON data or something like that, you'll be a lot better off with resources.
So I'm going to switch a little bit to talking about some of the features that are slightly bigger features within ASP.NET 5. So one of the ones I noticed was that dependency injection is becoming part of ASP.NET 5. How does that differ from Unity, which has been there for quite some time?
Well, Unity is a container, basically, so it's something that you could use to achieve dependency injection. But then when it comes to frameworks, it's interesting how things have evolved over the years, particularly if you're looking at something like ASP.NET. The traditional approach to extensibility with the ASP.NET runtime, and well, there's a couple, actually. There would be things like the provider model, where when your application starts, there was some information that was read from your web.config file that would tell the runtime what membership provider to instantiate. So you had some flexibility through configuration there. And you could always have classes that you inherit from and override virtual methods and get some extensibility there. But I think once dependency injection and inversion of control in general started taking hold in the .NET ecosystem and people started to see the benefits of dependency injection, they became a little bit frustrated with frameworks that didn't have that capability baked into them from the start. And an example of that would be ASP.NET MVC, the previous versions of ASP.NET MVC, or some of the original versions didn't use dependency injection. And so when you wanted to change model binders or inject different things into controllers, there was always specific APIs for the different feature sets of that framework to be able to get them to behave differently, because every little piece had its own API for extending it and injecting different components or getting different components into place. So just by the fact that the ASP.NET runtime says, we will assume there's an inversion of control container, either one that we're providing or one that you add to the system. So something like Unity or Structure Map or Ninject. Just the fact that it uses that throughout the runtime is makes life a lot easier, because now instead of worrying about using APIs or configuration files to get the right components into place at runtime, you just set up your container. However you set up your container, maybe you still do it through XML configuration, but everything's consistent now, if that makes any sense.
No, absolutely. But I did read one thing, though, in one of the posts about it, that it was going to kind of follow the service locator pattern. But I remember when I was just reading about Ninject some years ago, I think it was Mark Seaman was claiming that the service locator is an anti-pattern.
A lot of people would say service locator is an anti-pattern, and I would... I'm not sure where that might have come up. I know there are some areas where a service locator pattern might be present, but if you look at the way you would use, for instance, ASP.NET MVC controllers, what you can do is just have constructor arguments that will be populated at runtime when the IOC container builds that controller for you, and it will just inject them. So it's that most of the pieces I've seen are not using service locator.
Okay. Now, it was just, as I say, it was just one article I'd come across. Another feature that seems to have improved significantly, or has changed at least significantly, is the configuration. Can you walk through that a little bit?
Yeah, configuration has definitely changed. The old configuration and system in ASP.NET was very hierarchical, and it relied on not just the web.config XML file that was in your folder, but also a web.config XML file that was in a machine folder, as well as a machine.config file that was somewhere in the Windows, you know, .NET installation folder. And the settings from all of those different files would combine to produce your runtime configuration. All of that is completely gone. So now when you have an ASP.NET 5 project, there is no web.config. Well, there might be a web.config, but the web.config won't be for ASP.NET anymore. But you still might use a web.config to control IIS settings if you're going to host an IIS. And basically what the ASP.NET team did again was they said, you know, how do people want to manage configuration these days? And the answer is usually not hierarchical XML files. I don't think many people desire that solution anymore. So out of the box, what you can do is you get to tell ASP.NET what your configuration sources are. And some of the built-in configuration sources that are supported out of the box include using a JSON file for configuration. So if you need to manage, let's say, a database connection string, you can put a database connection string inside of a JSON file and tell ASP.NET that that JSON file is part of your configuration source, and that just allows you to read configuration information very easily. And you can also add... any files, and you can add environment variables, and environment variables turn out to be very useful because it's nice to go to a production server that only certain people can log into and have things like passwords, database passwords, and so forth specified in an environment variable instead of a text file that maybe other people can get to and read, or something that's checked into source control. And what you can do with ASP.NET is you can basically say, here's my configuration. My configuration will start with this JSON file that you find in this folder. And then I also want to include environment variables. And so you still have sort of this hierarchy, but you can think of it as overriding. So you go to look for a database connection string. ASP.NET might find it in the JSON file, but it also might find it in the environment variables. And since you specified environment variables last, that's the one that wins. Know what I mean?
Yep. And I think, so you mentioned their configuration source. It's one of these overridable methods. So you can pretty much say your entity framework can be your source or your Azure key values. But one thing I was surprised was that the INI files are back. I remember INI files from the days of Windows 3.1 and 3.11. And I think a lot of listeners may not remember those.
I certainly remember INI files, and I have a feeling there must be a story behind this. I don't know the story, but there must be a reason for INI files, and maybe the story is just that they're simpler than XML in a way for simple settings. So maybe that's why they came back.
Yeah. So another thing that I was reading about was this concept of middleware. And I read a couple of chapters about it. And to me, it kind of sounded a bit like a specification pattern or the way you can chain handlers in MVC. But I don't think that's the correct understanding, though.
Well, it's really just the idea of an HTTP processing pipeline where you can stick pieces of middleware that sit in the middle of that pipeline and they get to look at every incoming request and every outgoing response. Well, most of the components in your pipeline would be able to do that, but you can always have a component somewhere in your pipeline that doesn't call into the next handler in the pipeline. So you can certainly have pieces of middleware sitting there that don't execute during an HTTP request. But to take a step back, this all came around actually in previous versions of ASP.NET when Microsoft introduced Project Katana, which was their implementation of the OWEN specification. And the OWEN specification was really something that was driven by people who wanted to create an environment where you could write web applications that were a little more decoupled from their hosting environment. So not everyone wanted to use IIS. Not everyone wanted to know that they were running inside of an ASP.NET application domain that's under IIS and all this. They just wanted a really simple interface that says, here's an incoming HTTP request. Let me hand some information about that request to you using very simple types. So types like an iDictionary of string and object. So there's no iHTTP handler interfaces when you're talking about OWEN middleware or middleware. There's no abstract base classes or specific types that you have to implement. You basically just need functions that take this context, this dictionary of string and object, and inspect that. And in that dictionary, you can pull out, let's say, a request object and get information about the request, like cookies and headers and so forth. And you can get a response object, and you can write out a response body and a status code and so forth. And so at the very lowest level, OWEN was really just about decoupling the application that was running from the hosting environment and the environment that it's running inside of. ASP.NET 5 now is using middleware, I would say, even ASP.NET 5 is using more middleware than previous versions of ASP.NET. So if you look at how ASP.NET MVC works in ASP.NET 5, ASP.NET MVC works because there's a piece of middleware that you would install in your HTTP processing pipeline. And what this piece of middleware would do is look at an incoming request and see if that request should be satisfied by an MVC controller. And if it should be satisfied by an MVC controller because some routing rule matched up, then that middleware will pass things into the MVC components that know how to, you know, instantiate a controller and render a view or whatever you have to do there. But you can have other small pieces of middleware that also sit in that processing pipeline and do things like serve up static files. So they'll look at an incoming request and see if it matches a file on the disk, and if so, serve up that file or respond with that file. And you can have middleware to check for authorization tokens and make access checks and authorization checks and perform logging. There's all sorts of interesting middleware out there now.
And would you use them in combination with things like filters and handlers? Or do they have a different intention?
Well, they're all very similar in the sense that they all get to participate in an HTTP request. Now, the concept of handlers, things like HTTP handlers and HTTP modules, those concepts are gone.
Oh,
so if you, completely yeah, gone. So if you want to implement... If you're comfortable writing an HTTP module, the way you would write a module in ASP.NET 5 is to write a piece of middleware. So you would write a class that actually is going to look a lot like that module. Because you get to see an incoming request, you can make decisions about that request, you can stop the request and say, nope, something's gone wrong, just return a 401 unauthorized right now, or you can just let the request continue. So if you're writing an HTTP module, you would be writing middleware in ASP.NET 5. And if you're writing a low-level HTTP handler, you could also do that with middleware in ASP.NET 5. But then the question, original question was then, you know, how do things like filters come into play? And filters are very similar, action filters, but they would be more tied to just requests that are operating inside of the MVC runtime, things that are getting to controllers and controllers actions. Whereas middleware, a piece of middleware sits at a higher level. So you could write a piece of middleware that sees more than just the MVC request. You could write a piece of middleware that sees everything going on.
And when you say everything, what would be the other things? Like, are these the static file requests?
Yeah, static file requests. So now the way middleware works is, if you've ever heard the term Russian doll model, that's kind of the pattern that the middleware
works. The doll inside the doll inside the doll?
Right. So the first piece of middleware that you install in the pipeline, that would be the first component in your application to receive an HTTP request. So that first component can look at that request, and maybe all it does is it's logging what time does the request start and what time does the response end. So the incoming request comes in and it says, it, you know, sets some timestamp somewhere. And then it can call into the next piece of middleware. So you can think of the next piece of middleware sort of embedded in that first piece of middleware. And that next piece of middleware, you can write a piece of middleware that all it does is always just write the string hello world. You know, maybe that's all it does. So next piece of middleware gets called, it puts hello world into the response. It doesn't try to call into a third piece of middleware. It doesn't call into next. All it does is say, okay, here's the response. Well, when that piece of middleware exits, you kind of jump back into the outer doll, because it literally has called into the second one, and now the second one is complete. You're back out in the first one, and now in the first piece of middleware, you know, you are now sort of in the outgoing phase, or in the response phase, because you've called into the next component. You don't know how deep that went, but some component inside of there has, you know, decided that things are finished. You're unwinding the call stack, you're coming back out, and now you, in that first piece of middleware, you could say, okay, this is the end of the response, so I'll record another timestamp and subtract the two and see how long that took. So constructing your middleware pipeline will be something that in some applications requires a little bit of thought, because if you do have, say, like a piece of logging middleware that wants to look at everything, then you'll typically want to install that very early in the pipeline. Because if you have, let's say you're building a site that requires authentication for everything, when you put that piece of middleware inside of there, there's some request that will not get past that piece of middleware because it's preventing unauthorized or unauthenticated requests from getting through the rest of the pipeline.
So I'm going to change a little bit again to MVC and Web API have been unified now.
Yes.
What implications does that have for me as a MVC and a Web API developer?
Well, I think it makes things easier, and I wish this was true from the very start. Yeah. I wish there was had never been two different frameworks, but MVC and Web API always had a lot of overlap. They had very similar concepts when it came to things like filters and model binders and controllers, and there was a lot of overlap. By unifying and combining these things, now you really only have to learn about one set of filters and one set of action results and one set of model binders. So I think it makes things conceptually easier. It still allows you to build web applications that are API focused, or the type of applications that like to render HTML, or make it easy to combine those two. So you could certainly build a web app that does both, provide API endpoints as well as HTML endpoints.
Is it true? But,
I think it makes life easier. No, go ahead.
I saw that Razor, I don't know whether it's gone away, but they've come out with a thing called Tag Helpers, which you can use instead of Razor.
Well, Tag Helpers plug into the Razor View engine. So the Razor View engine is still there, and you can still create a controller that says return view, and it will look up the proper CSHTML file, and you can still pass your model in there, and all of that stuff is the same. Where Tag Helpers come in is they're ultimately going to be a replacement for HTML helpers. HTML helpers were those little pieces of C# code where you could say things inside of a Razor view like, HTML.dropdownList4 or HTML.actionLink. And they were always cumbersome. They were always noisy. They always had a very difficult API. I mean, even HTML.actionLink, I used to hate using, well, hate's a strong word. It always made some of my hair stand up when I had to use HTML.actionLink, because here's all I want to do is something very simple. I want to put an anchor tag in my HTML and have it point to a URL. But I kind of want that URL to be robust and know about not hard code a URL, but say I need to go to this action on this controller and pass these parameters. And using HTML.actionLink was just always irritating, I'll put it that way, because the IntelliSense window pops up and there's 10 different overloads and parameters flip around, and it was just crazy. Tag helpers are beautiful because they get rid of all of that. I don't know if you've ever used Angular, but I find tag helpers to me are sort of like Angular directives. What a tag helper can be, a tag helper could be something like an attribute that you put on an HTML element. And when the Razor View engine is executing, if it knows about that tag helper and sees that attribute by that name, it will call into a component where you can execute some C# code to do whatever you want to do. So here's an example. Instead of saying HTML.actionLink and then passing in a parameter that says, here's the text that I want to display, and here's the controller I want it to reach, and here's the action I want it to reach, and here's the parameters I want it to reach, you can instead write your regular anchor tag, which is everyone is familiar with, and say something like ASP-controller equals home. So the tag helper is ASP-controller. And because you have that attribute on the element, there's a piece of C# code that can get invoked and say, oh, you want to build an anchor tag and have it point to this controller. I now have enough information to start building the URL for you. So there are just ways to enrich HTML when you're doing server-side rendering that aren't as obnoxious as HTML helpers.
Yeah, I used to have the same problem with the anchor tags because the overloads were confusing. If you had this, I don't know, if you had 5 parameters, it meant one thing, but if you needed a 6th, yes, the position might change, and you'd have to have.
Yes.
And then drop down. Yeah,
it was quite common to build an MVC application where a link was something like that included length equals 6 or something like that in the URL, because it was looking at one of your strings and just taking properties off of a string object and putting them into the URL. It was unfriendly.
And then the other one that I use, I always have to go back to documentation or back to a blog post I wrote myself just to keep it in my head, were drop-down lists. They were all incredibly painful, incredibly confusing.
Yeah, I wrote a few articles on my blog about HTML.dropdownlist, and I still get emails about that today, people trying to figure out drop-down lists and how they work and what's wrong with my code.
I can't figure it out. I have to just go back to what I did before and go, oh, okay. Here's the source. Here's the thing I'm going to save the value into. Okay. But it's very confusing. Has that improved with the tag helpers?
I'll have to check. I don't know if there's a tag helper for drop-down lists anymore. I think, hopefully, people are sort of migrating away from some of these things and actually getting more into what you can do with HTML. I mean, I don't think a select HTML select element was really that difficult that we needed an HTML helper for it. But I think in the Microsoft community that we were so accustomed to using controls and widgets and things that the framework provides that if there is a helper to create a drop-down list, well, then I'm going to use it. But, you know, maybe that's... I have the sense that that type of behavior is lessening.
I hope so. It is moving to a cleaner look and feel. Is it right that web forms are gone now from ASP.NET 5?
Yes. So in ASP.NET 5, there's no web forms. That's true. Okay,
good. That's a step forward.
I think some things were just so tied to system.web that they're just not in the cards for the future, I don't think.
So one of the things, I was having a chat with a friend of mine a few days ago, and we were talking about cloud and private cloud and public cloud and how to use them. And I was saying that, you know, a lot of times you come out with new tools, but people often use them in the old way. So I can imagine people are going to use middleware in the way they used handlers or filters, and maybe they should or they shouldn't. And I've often found that with Microsoft, there tends to be a significant lack of simple and clear documentation. Like just last week, I was trying to figure out whether I needed to have whether I needed to dispose in EF context. And it took me over an hour to find yes, maybe no. And even then, when I had a unit of work wrapping around it, and finding the right way to call it dispose. I've been programming .NET since 2005, and you'll find articles which are in direct opposition about how you dispose something. So is Microsoft doing anything with ASP.NET 5 to bring better education, giving better examples and saying, look, in this scenario, it should be this way. In some other scenario, it should be some other way.
I think there's good and bad there. So let's talk about the good first. Sure. I remember back in the early releases of ASP.NET where there was always this group of secret insiders that would get preview builds, and everything was always very hush-hush. And then there was a release date where, wow, we're going to open everything up and release things and surprise everybody. And, you know, here's all this great new stuff. And I think that did create environments where you would get this technology, and there was really not enough experience out there in the world for people to write about what is working and what's not working. It was just new, so new to everyone, right? Whereas now what's happening is all of the stuff is open source. The ASP.NET team has regular chats in the open on YouTube and so forth, where they do this community stand up and talk about issues and what's working and what's not working, and should we use this and should we not use that. And I think that's good. I think that's going to lead to more practical documentation, and more people will have real world experience with this stuff when it's released. And that'll create a better condition for everybody, I think. The only downside is things are changing a lot faster than they used to. So you used to, you know, back in the old days, again, when you had the big bang releases, there was also an army of tech writers putting together proper documentation for everything. Things are a lot more streamlined now, and I don't think we'll ever see that level of formal documentation ever again. But hopefully we'll see more code, you know, sample applications, third-party blog posts, because people, you know, have been using this for a year now, those types of things.
So one kind of area that I tend not to work in is front-end, but I understand that Angular, Knockout, and Bootstrap have become sort of first-class members of Visual Studio 2015, and in turn, ASP.NET 5, is that a fair comment?
Well, I wouldn't... Yes and no. So certainly if you do file new project in Visual Studio, you'll get a website that includes Bootstrap. A lot of people use Bootstrap. It makes for a nice responsive website. So, you know, that's fine. I don't know really that, you know, they've decided on using any particular JavaScript framework or not. But here's the deal with Visual Studio 2015. They've obviously said, look, there's some things that the rest of the world is better building than we are. We are the ASP.NET team at Microsoft, so we're going to focus on things that go into Visual Studio, and we're going to focus on the ASP.NET runtime. And when it comes to things like JavaScript tools and JavaScript frameworks and CSS frameworks and CSS tools, there's already an entire ecosystem out there of great tools. And we're just going to make Visual Studio, we're going to give Visual Studio the ability to leverage those tools. So as an example, let's say you do want to build something with Angular, Aurelia, Bootstrap, jQuery, Durandal, whatever. In ASP.NET 5, you'll no longer be installing these things through NuGet with ASP.NET 5. And in general, in the future, I don't see NuGet doing anything other than .NET assemblies anymore. So the last couple of years, people have been dumping everything into NuGet, right? jQuery's a NuGet package. Angular's a NuGet package. You can download all this stuff through NuGet, but it's really a better tool for doing .NET stuff. The JavaScript world and the rest of the world, they already have tools that they use to install JavaScript libraries and CSS frameworks. They are tools like NPM that runs under Node.js, and tools like Bower that runs under Node.js. And so ASP.NET 5 is going to leverage those things. And in Visual Studio, you can now get IntelliSense in a Bower.json file and in a Node packages.json file. If I'm making
Bower, some sense there. I read about this a little earlier, just for people who don't know. Bower... I'm just reading what it says, is a package manager for client-side libraries, including both JavaScript and CSS.
Right. There's a few of them out there for JavaScript and CSS now, but NPM is by far the most popular, in general, JavaScript package manager. And people use that for both server-side stuff and Node, but also client-side stuff too. And then Bower was a tool from the development team at Twitter that said, we want to focus exclusively on front-end. We want to focus exclusively on front-end stuff. So we're going to create a package manager that specializes in giving you jQuery and Bootstrap and Angular and all those front-end development tools. So you can use that stuff with Visual Studio. Another example of the direction we're headed is Visual Studio, there used to be tools to minify JavaScript and bundle JavaScript together so that you would produce a very small, efficient download of your JavaScript files to the consumer of your website. Those types of things are going away too. So again, going back to the scenario, you're going to build a web application on ASP.NET 5, and it's going to use Angular and Bootstrap, let's say. You're going to download Angular and Bootstrap not through NuGet anymore, but through NPM or Bower or one of these JavaScript package managers. And then the way you're going to minify and bundle and build your JavaScript, it's not with any tools that are shipped by Microsoft, but with tools that are in the JavaScript ecosystem like Grunt or Gulp. And they will plug into Visual Studio. You can get a little bit of a UI, like Visual Studio understands what a Gulp file is. Gulp, for those don't know, you can think of it like MS Build for JavaScript. So it's a task runner. You tell it where files are and what to do to those files and where to put the output. Visual Studio understands a Gulp file, and it can show you what tasks are inside, like build or clean or lint or compile. Because a lot of people are writing JavaScript code these days that needs to be compiled or transpiled into a different version of the language.
Do you know when ASP.NET 5 is going to be available to everyone?
The plan right now is the first quarter of 2016. And if anyone's interested, if you just search for ASP.NET 5 roadmap, you should find a post that the ASP.NET team has made on their GitHub repository that basically lays out their roadmap. And they have a few more beta releases throughout the rest of the year. There's a release candidate by the end of the year, and then the release will be sometime early next year.
Do you think it'll change much between now and then?
I don't think so, because I have a feeling they'll be able to ship and then just they'll be able to keep iterating quickly. So.
Any final notes, Scott?
No, not on ASP.NET 5, I guess. If anyone is interested, I do have a Pluralsight course that covers an early version of ASP.NET 5. Of course, it's changed a lot since then, but hopefully sometime around the release or maybe even before that, I'll have a full ASP.NET 5 course on Pluralsight.com that covers all the basics and essentials you'll need to know.
Your Pluralsight courses, you cover far more than just .NET, I think.
Well, yeah, I've dived into a lot of JavaScript stuff, and I even have courses that use Python, so it's fun.
Well, thank you very much, Scott Allen, for your time this evening.
Oh, thank you.